Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. Before we begin this week's episode, here's a message about our partner, Global Witness. Global Witness, a pioneering campaigning NGO that exposes the environmental and human rights abuses by some of the world's biggest companies and most powerful political figures. For 25 years, they've campaigned against the exploitation of the Earth's natural resources, the destruction of indigenous peoples, and corruption that has siphoned billions of dollars from the poorest countries. Global Witness doesn't just expose the abuse of power, it works to transform the systems that allow this abuse to flourish unchecked. Find out more at globalwitness.org. I'm very pleased today to welcome Professor Danny Dorling to the podcast. Danny is an English social geographer and is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography of the School of Geography and the Environment of the University of Oxford, and previously a Professor of Geography at the University of Sheffield. His work primarily concerns issues of housing, health, employment, education, wealth and poverty. A prolific author, Danny has written All That Is Solid, Injustice, Why Social Inequality Still Persists, and A Better Politics. Slow Down, The End of the Great Acceleration, and Why It's Good for the Planet, the Economy and Our Lives was published earlier this year. So thank you very much, Danny, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Thanks ever so much for having me.
So I'm very much looking forward to talking to you about your new book and recent books and research, Danny. Just maybe to begin by way of background for listeners, can you maybe set the scene a little bit, what you do, what your research interests are in general?
Okay. I'm a professor of geography, which means I can do many things. The great thing about geography in the UK as an academic discipline is there really aren't any boundaries to what you're allowed to look at. I began a very long time ago in the late 1980s looking at computer mapping and visualization. And then I began to look at inequality, mainly because inequality was rising in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. Trends over time is what interests me. And so the Slowdown book, the most recent thing, is trying to get a sense of what is changing in what direction. And it wasn't supposed to be called Slow Down. It was supposed to be a book about what's getting faster and what's slowing down. But I couldn't find enough things that were actually speeding up, hence the book. So I get to play with data. That's mainly what I do. I use data to address arguments, which are often political, but I try to throw something in, which is new, for people. And if it's new for me, if I find something that surprises me by looking at numbers, then I hope it's also new for the readers and listeners.
Very interesting. And a counterintuitive topic, really, slow down for many people. I guess their experience or the way we relate to early 21st century life is one of a sense of things speeding up. That's the story we're telling as well. So we come on to that, and it's very interesting indeed. I'd like to set the scene also a little bit, and just clearly we facing a number of serious interlocking environmental crises, social crises. I'm just wondering what in particular is on your mind at the moment, Danny?
Oh, well, as of today, while we're talking, I'm based in England, and it's what is going to happen next with inequality in the population. What happens with the furlough schemes? I've just been looking at a Treasury report today where the UK Treasury claims its intervention slightly narrowed the gap between rich and poor, and I've found it's completely wrong. You just look at their numbers and they've interpreted them wrong. They may have made a genuine mistake. But at the very end of that report, they cite two other reports which they say back them up. And so I went to look at those and found that they didn't. So that's the kind of thing I look at. I mean, my worry, and it's an obvious worry for most people, is we are looking at increasing numbers of people who are going to be, in some ways, destitute. Currently, I'm speaking to you at the end of July, It's about 10 million households in the UK are facing destitution, 25 million people. And this is even before the furlough schemes, which haven't helped reduce inequalities much, are wound up, before all the school leavers and university leavers try to enter a job market which doesn't exist in September and October. So that's today's preoccupation.
A grim picture. It seems in many ways that some tectonic plates are shifting. I mean, during the crisis, side by side of tremendous stories, I guess, of individual solidarity, at the same time, there are all kinds of machinations going on. The US is rolling back environmental protection. We see emergency government powers in many countries for how long, who knows. Unaccountable deals with suppliers, as we see in the UK. And at the same time, there does seem to be a genuine, people seem not to want things to go back to normal in various different ways. At least that's what they're saying. There's talk of a wealth tax, or it's a whisper maybe, universal basic income in Spain. Periods like this where things are, should we say, fluid. I'm just wondering, how do you parse the current situation? I mean, maybe talk about the UK first, but any other and things we need to look out for that are indicators, because we're right in the middle of it, and I know it's not easy to read the tea leaves in that respect.
No, it isn't, and you've always got to be aware of we have a real sort of short-termism about us. We tend to think that the month or the year that we're living in is incredibly important. And the political events of our time are incredibly important. However, this might be it. But you need to have that in the back of your mind. Incredible surveys of the population being done, for instance, by the Office of National Statistics, discovering that large proportions of people have actually quite welcomed many of the changes to their lives. They didn't like commuting into the office to do that boring job that they were doing. And that is interesting, even with the fear of destitution rising. And again, just to give you an example of the myopic kind of thinking, we're speaking on the 23rd of July, and on the 23rd of July, two House of Commons committees, the Treasury Committee and the Public Affairs Committee, both produced reports damning the government. And what's fascinating about this is that both committees have a majority of Conservative MPs on them. So it's not what you would necessarily expect. We are at a point when things really could change, not least because it's very, very hard to see how they could carry on as they were before. And then the worry is, will they change in the right direction? To what extent will people be carried with the change and looked after? To what extent might the change become an even greater crisis? Or will we be sensible in the way that we do things? And I tend to look across the whole of Europe, which is gives you cause for much greater optimism than looking at the United States, for instance. It's easy to focus, or Brazil, it's easy to focus on areas that are worst. All looking, it has to be said, at Eastern Asia, looking at Japan and Vietnam and above all else, China, and in some ways how well they have dealt with the pandemic, which, all else being equal, should have hurt them the most because it came there first.
Yes, yes, absolutely. That's very interesting. And unfolding, as you say, currently right now. I guess it brings up an issue I maybe was going to talk about a little later, but I don't quite know where this falls, one of your hats, Danny, but how social change happens. As you say, because the political system here in the UK, it doesn't seem to matter what people think at a certain level. Well, it's a tremendous conservative majority. And certainly, I guess, well, that's looking over maybe a 5-year time horizon, which maybe on the grand scale of things isn't that long. But is that something you've looked at or get a sense of?
I have done a few papers on turning points in history, trying to guess at how social change happens. And this is with measures. So the things I look at are inequalities, the gap between the rich and the poor, how that fell and then rose. But other things, people's attitudes, the extent to which people are racist and so on. Actually, even the number of children that people have and at what age they have them. And one interesting thing there is that if you draw some of these graphs over 100 years of some of these changes, general elections appear to have almost no effect on them. That's not saying that politics doesn't matter, but that's saying you shouldn't get carried away with the fact that there is a giant conservative majority now. It doesn't necessarily mean, or take the turn towards inequality. That turn actually began around about 1974, 75 or 76 in the UK, before the 79 government came in. Now, of course, that government solidified it, but then they won elections in 83 and 87, and at the same time in the States, Reagan was in. But the fact that it began before, I think, really matters. And we can often look at the wrong thing and see it as crucial. In hindsight now, for the UK, trying to ask, how did the UK go from being one of the most equitable countries in Europe? Of large countries, only Sweden was more equal in the 70s. How did it go from that to being the most inequitable, the biggest gap between rich and poor now, and why? And you have to then look at what was different about the UK to other countries. And the big difference in hindsight was that, unlike anywhere else in the rest of Europe, the UK, and particularly England, has been the heart of the biggest empire the world had ever known, and was losing its colonies, and lost India after the war, but then lost numerous colonies in Africa in the 60s and some in the 70s. And anywhere which is the heart of an empire, when it loses its empire, gets poorer. And, you know, that's the lens that I look at that turn. And I look at the voting in the UK. And you could look now at the crisis of identity now that England in particular has, all this going around about Brexit and what else we're doing, and say, if we could only step back, if we only had a way of travelling forward in time and looking back and disengaging ourselves, it may well be that there was something else extremely odd. And, you know, because I look at inequality and the fact we'd become the most unequal country, I can't help thinking that that was a real precursor to what's been happening in the UK recently. People in favour of inequality always put down the problems that inequality causes. For instance, being able to get a house, being able to get your kids into school, or the problems of a health service. They always tend to put it down to immigrants. That's what you blame, when the real reason is rising inequality. And it kind of fits our times at the moment. One fortunate thing about being in a pandemic is at least it's kind of shut people up a bit about immigration at the moment. Well, in fact, more than that, the Black Lives Matter movement rising up, the agenda so very fast, is probably not independent of the fact that we're living through a pandemic.
Right. That's very interesting. You mentioned that this inequality started at maybe earlier in the 70s. To what extent, I mean, when we talk about the climate and the environmental crisis, some of the people I've spoken to talk about, you know, particular phase of what they call neoliberal economics, extreme globalized markets, deregulation and so forth, having a huge impact on various aspects of that. To what extent is that also, do you think, an important driving factor in inequality?
Oh, well, there was a limits to growth issue. We were, after the Second World War, clocking up increases of GDP 2 or 3% a year, sometimes even more, that were utterly unsustainable. And we were doing that by exploiting more of the planet, by exploiting populations, growing populations in the poor part of the world. They were a market that was growing. And that absolutely clearly was not sustainable. But it was hard to see at the time. And also, those who were saying it's not sustainable also couldn't see the change coming. The thing that interests me most on this is there was a book called The Population Bomb, which was published in 1968. And it was actually published at the height of human population growth, when growth was rising by about 2.1% a year in the total number of humans on the planet. And there was a mathematician who wrote a paper pointing out that at this rate of growth, everybody would be, within a couple of hundred years, the whole planet would be a swarming mass of human beings all touching each other. And what he was trying to say is, we're at a high point. This is not going to continue. It can't continue. The news this week, an article in The Lancet suggesting that population growth may peak at 8 or 9 billion rather than 10, or sometimes the UN says 11. That is by the year before 2100. And this gives your listeners a sense of what we don't know. Like, we're talking about within the next 80 years, what's going to happen to the number of people on the planet, and will, for the first time in human history without disaster, will the size of our species stop rising? And we're that unsure. But to contrast that back, 1968, the population bomb, they thought it was all over. The book ends talking about letting people die in poor parts of the world and not sending food. And now this week, we have a debate going on about, are we going to peak much earlier? How incredibly low fertility rates have got, how few children people are having, even before the effects of the pandemic, which we think will actually produce it even more. Korea is now famously well less than one child per couple. That's halving. And news reporters are writing stories about data coming out at the moment, just saying how fewer children we are having. So, you know, there is quite a change going on. And there's also just so much we don't know. I think the population numbers are so useful for when we talk about certainty and other things. The fact we do not even know how many of us there will be, and this is within 80 years, which is less than a human lifetime in the rich parts of the world.
Fascinating. I want to talk about population in an environmental context in a moment, but firstly, how important is population growth economically? I mean, a big topic, but kind of give an overview of that. I'm not sure something that's always clearly understood.
Oh, no, it isn't. And it was really very important to capitalism. It's the form of capitalism that we have had, and, you know, which sort of began 400 years ago, but really didn't spread greatly until 300, 250 years ago, relies on ever greater markets. And you can get ever greater markets in various ways. One is by invading places and bringing them into your system. So the UK invaded, I think it's 173 of the current, or 171 of the current 193 members of the UN. And I think the country I'm in walked in uninvited at some point. But also you get growing markets if you have population growth. And if you look at how from when it was about 1820, we went from 1 billion to 2 billion to 4 billion to now almost 8 billion. That allows you to sell more shirts. It allows you to sell more bottles of Coca-Cola, particularly to a young population. You only have to do as well as you were doing the year before. And if your market is getting bigger, you can make a profit, and making a profit is what it's all about. That becomes dramatically harder as population growth ends, which is already done in Japan and is about to do in many other places in much of Europe, actually, we're seeing it. But also as people get older, wiser, harder to fool by advertising, and as also people become much better educated. You know, we're sending majorities to university in much of this continent at the moment. And the idea that you will be able to convince them that they need to buy such a quantity of goods, such an enormous amount of clothes for themselves, more than they could ever wear out, or convince them that they need to keep on buying new computers, because this is what fascinates me. You know, I'm using my computer to do word processing, bit of a spreadsheet, okay, some video processing, but nothing I couldn't do on the Windows system I had in 1989. But yet, the people who make computers are managing to design them to become obsolete within a few years. And this kind of thing is ridiculous.
Yeah. The inequality, on the one hand, we're talking about, and a small percentage of people who control, you know, huge portions of resources and population. And it's interesting in respect to the carbon emissions. And I know Oxfam, I think it was Oxfam, did a report, and I know this is something you've looked at as well, is what a significant proportion of carbon emissions are due to rich consumers, shall we say.
Oh yeah. It's incredible. Oxfam have done good reports, but also Piketty and his colleagues have done some brilliant reports on this. And it's staggering that the top 10% produce the large majority of carbon. The bottom 50% in any country, a really small amount for that country. Every day, more people are born who will never fly. It's really skewed. Yeah, worrying about population numbers and carbon is just silly.
Well, yeah, that's an important trope. It's an idea which is seems to be quite well established and in certain communities. You mentioned the carbon problem or the global warming, and they go straight to this question of population.
It's interesting because the green movement used to be worried about population massively, and then the majority of it moved. You know, that George Monbiot writes about why population isn't the problem, and so on. I saw Jonathan, the head of Friends of the Earth, still worrying about it, but generally it's older men in the green movement who worry about population now, and not others. That battle has largely been won. But also, I've got to make a confession here. You know, I work in the School of Geography and the Environment. I think of myself as fairly green. But when the pandemic came in March, 12 flights I had been booked on to go and give talks were cancelled. And I had no idea I was going to be flying 12 times. I had taken it out of my head that I was doing that. I didn't count going to Ireland as flying.
Yeah. Yes. I was going to ask, what is the consumption? Because there are 24 hours in a day. Where is this excess consumption, you know, that's driving the carbon? Is it, as you're suggesting, that a lot of it's to do with flying?
Flying and other travel and driving and, you know, big cars. And also, I mean, we have a significant number of households in the UK who have more cars than they can actually drive and are driving a lot. But also not worrying about the heating bill, because if you are in the top 10%, it's a bit annoying when you get the heating bill, but it's not, you never turn the thermostat down because you're trying to save money. It's poor people who do that. But the embedded carbon in the things that we buy, and the fact that we throw away so much, these enormous waste bins outside our houses. The average family now throws away six times more than its parents did. And I can see this clearly in my family. We have three enormous bins outside. Okay, one's recycling, one's garden, one is conventional waste. They're all at least twice as big as the tiny tin bin that the family of six I grew up in had. And I grew up in a middle-class household. So it's the embedded carbon in things that are purchased. But also, for the extremely rich, running two or three properties, or if you're in America, 11, 12, or 13 properties, if you're very rich, the cost of doing that, moving between those properties, having private planes, it's quite staggering.
Yes. Now, you mentioned in the book that, clearly on the face of it, a falling population or a decrease in the rate of population growth is good news environmentally, in terms of resources that are being used and so forth. But I wonder, and in your book, to what extent you take into account the fact that the idea, I guess, of the ecological footprint and the consumption patterns of America, which are clearly, you know, multiple of other countries, even developed countries, but that poorer countries are on that trajectory, and maybe not with that pace, and maybe not going to that scale, but understandably, there are, you know, huge sections of the population in the world who do want and need a higher standard of living and material goods to go with that. And is that not still very worrying?
Well, it's worrying, but most worrying at all is that we are paying a proportion of society to convince people that they want more things. You know, the whole advertising industry is all about convincing you want something that if they didn't convince you, you wouldn't otherwise get. So we should worry about that. In America, I think it's 4% of GDP goes in advertising. In the UK, it's 2%, and in mainland Europe, it's 1%.
But yeah, from a research perspective, where would you point to show what a natural level of consumption is? Because there are all kinds of things that go into that drive consumption. And clearly, you've got the conspicuous consumption and relative consumption and things like that.
Okay, I would do it pragmatically. So there are two countries I'd point to in the rich world which are Finland and Japan. And they're, if you look at their levels of consumption, they show what is possible. Now, the problem for both of those countries is that we, if everybody behaved like the average person in Japan, we would still need two planets. But in the US, it's four planets. So there's still a long way to go, even from those countries which have done the best, and often not done the best by planning to do the best, simply because the ways in which their societies are organized, people don't need to consume as much. For instance, in Japan, it's a society based on public transport. Every year, the number of cars in Japan, I think for over 20 years, has fallen compared to the year before. Not because of a government policy, but just because driving is such a stupid thing to do. Whereas in the United States, the extreme example in the States was I think it's a small town in Texas, where the mayor opposed the introduction of pavements, where, you know, people could walk, because pavements, he said, was the beginning of the road to communism. And, you know, it's these huge differences in how we plan, how we operate, how we live our lives. But Japan and Finland, it's about two planets, so it obviously needs to, carbon reduction needs to halve in those two. But other people in the world could come up to that level, and it's sustainable. And you could also look at a few small technological advances. I'm against seeing technology as our way out of this. But the growing of protein without sunlight, actually absorbing carbon, which allows you not to factory farm meat, those kind of things are happening now. But it's the choice of actually doing it, of implementing it, that will matter. And the other one is changing our patterns of holidays, what we do to enjoy ourselves. This idea that you have to fly to get away to rest, again, that was a fabricated thing. And if we look at the data, if we look at people's happiness, which I've done in the UK, we actually find that holidays, even though people listening might be crying out for a holiday, or, you know, they've just had one, their first one all year. But on average, the net effect of a holiday on happiness is zero. Often because our expectations, I think, are higher. People end up arguing, it rains, it's not as great as you thought.
Sure. That underlying it is this idea called the hedonic cycle, or the idea that beyond a certain level of material welfare, that happiness and other variables like that don't improve.
Yeah. And the other thing, if you want to be optimistic about this, is how much we are discovering about ourselves. We're very mean with ourselves. We get very frustrated that we can't learn really, really quickly. But it's only been since the 1950s or 60s in the USA that we've known what it is like for a population to have mass affluence. This really is quite recent. My parents were middle class, but both grew up with no double glazing, because nobody had double glazing. You had ice on the inside of the windows. You got cold at times in a way that is unnecessary. So the affluence that we have now, which we don't need to improve much further, is new. Air conditioning is a lovely example. You don't need a new kind of air conditioning in the future that is accurate to within a tenth of a degree. Air conditioning works. You have to worry about the power that's used for it. You have to work out how on earth can we do it without consuming so much power. But it isn't that there is yet another increase in standard of living where we heat better, where we, you know, create our environment better. We've got there in many ways. You know, we have a washing machine and a tumble dryer. There isn't a third and fourth white box that is needed. Somebody was desperately trying to invent one to get us to buy. But it's that realization matters.
The consumer society is entirely or very largely driven by advertising. I mean, if you look at, we're talking about consumerism, and which is, I guess, more broadly a kind of materialism. You know, do you not need to kind of unpack that a little bit and look at some of that, and maybe, you know, what is materialism about? That in a way, I mean, clearly advertising is important and a significant driver. But in terms of change, in terms of looking at new ways forward, do you think just reducing, you know, banning advertising, I'm not suggesting that you're you know, is the way forward? I mean, we live in a very materialistic moment.
Yeah. We do. It's tricky, but again, we're discovering things. It's my optimism. So, you know, when I was a child, hunter gatherers were thought of as primitive, living short and brutal lives. You know, within my lifetime, we discovered hunter gatherers grew to be 6 foot tall, only had to work for a few hours a day, and had a mechanism of mocking people who were too greedy or jealous to stop materialism rising in hunter-gathering societies. We've discovered that we became stunted when we farmed, and we discovered we didn't farm out of choice but out of necessity, and it wasn't much fun. We then discovered that the Industrial Revolution produced the shortest human beings ever, the most, you know, damaged bodies. And all these things are within my lifetime, and that's what makes me optimistic. And you could say, you know, I'm a well-off person, but I'm actually sitting in a house in Oxford that was built by a college servant in the 30s. It's a small house, not particularly well built, but it's absolutely fine for us. I'm not a hair shirt person, but and also I guess pandemic helps a bit as well, work out what you actually need and what you're lucky to have. And I've been lucky enough, of course. I'm a university professor. I know what it's like to stay in a 4-star or 5-star hotel. I know after the first or second time you do it, it's not that special. But the danger is, you know, I can tell people these things, but there's this kind of gnawing feeling that you'll be happy if you have something. The trickiest one is travel. You can get people to change all kinds of behavior. You can get them to give up their car and so on. But telling youngsters that it would be better if they didn't travel is hard. You can tell them, explore where you are first. But I think we will need ways of moving around the world. But they could be slow. But we are not going to stop people's instinct to move, because that's quite innate in us, an instinct to explore.
Yes, yes. Another counterintuitive idea, I guess, is this idea about the pace of change and the standstill potential standstill or future standstill in innovation and technology.
Yes, yes. Yeah, this is the biggest thing I think I found in slowdown. You know, we are constantly told the world has never changed as fast as it's changing now, but it will never change as slow again, these kind of things. And people love the idea because they're stressed in their lives often, of thinking, I'm stressed because change is happening so fast. But you've only got to look at your grandparents' lives and look at what existed when they were born and what existed when they died. I mean, for my grandparents, I'm 52, so they're quite old. They were... two of them were born in the era of Queen Victoria, Justin. They were born when there were not tractors in the fields. There were horses. They saw air flight invented, not just invented, but actually become something that was mass used. They saw people land on the moon. They saw the introduction of computers. And then we in our lives go, oh, but I got the internet. We're going, that wasn't quite as big. They saw, well, before them, but the telephone. You know, incredible innovation, the ability to speak with people remotely. And the telephone is a much bigger innovation than seeing somebody on a video screen. The innovations have been less. My favorite example in the book was the big innovation fair that happens every year in the US. Last year, 2019, the biggest headline was that somebody had invented a mobile phone where you could bend the screen. And that kind of gives you the idea of how they'd run out of new things to do.
What's the driver of that, do you think? Why would that be the case? Well, I mean, I guess before that, I've got to say, you know, a lot of breathless reports on the internet and serious debate and discussions about, you know, AI, gene splicing, which are various gene-related technologies and so forth. And I'm just wondering, data is one thing, but in terms of trying to understand the motor and logic of change, why would it be the case that innovation would slow down?
Oh, okay. Because our innovations were connected to a change that happened with capitalism, and with the discovery that we could get energy from coal and then make electricity. And once you've discovered electricity, the first set of things to be invented, there's a lot of them to find. There's a lot you can do. But every decade after that, it reduces. I think the 1930s, was actually the highest rate of these innovations, not even the Second World war. We haven't invented a new kind of electricity, something else to do. The internet came from ARPANET. It was a Cold War thing. I was at University of Newcastle upon Tyne in 1986. We were lucky. We were on the main, one of the main nodes. We had email in 1986. You know, that's a long time ago. And you do, it has made a big change. The five biggest companies in the US are Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, and Netflix. You know, that's, and if you look back, only 20 years, less than that, the biggest companies were all involved in oil. They were oil companies or Walmart, which essentially is a car park with a shop in the middle of it. So it's also oil. So we get, because of this domination now by these companies connected to computing, we kind of think things are still changing rapidly, but they're just monopoly control. You know, a Google search engine is a really easy thing to program. It's a monopoly control that makes it powerful. Amazon, which actually, in terms of sustainability, is a very, very good idea. Having your goods brought to you by a single truck going up and down your street makes much more sense than endlessly driving yourself somewhere. But it's the monopoly control of it that makes it profitable, not the clever computing. Facebook famously was programmed by a university student. Any geek could have programmed Facebook at university. It's the particular greed of the United States, I think, managed to get them to capture these things. And we shouldn't see it as a sign of speeding up. The fact that we have these monopolies in control of something is a sign of it's kind of slowed down. It's being captured.
It's interesting you say that, and that makes a lot of sense. And yet for a lot of people, their experience, I think, driven by pervasive social media and the email, it means that it feels like things are never ending, 24/7, that you can get a work email at any time. You're expected to, you know, somehow to respond, and just this interconnected, never stop technology communications world we live in is undoubtedly hugely stressful and doesn't feel to most people that it's slowed down.
Well, it's not as stressful as a 60-hour working week in a factory, which you know we used to have, and it took a lot of effort to get that down from 60 hours. And we have a propensity to do this to ourselves. There's a lovely account, I think it's of Darwin, when the postal system would deliver 3 or 4 postal deliveries a day when it was done, you know. So Darwin could be getting one set of letters in the morning, another set of letters at noon, another for tea, and then another set for supper. And these were delivered by post people, postmen in most cases.
I was shocked to discover that. I had no idea that liberation of post.
But they do it. But so we have this happening to us, but also we have the propensity, we're learning, to put emails aside and deal with them later, to decide that we aren't going to try and sleep the amount we should sleep. We're going to spend time with people that we should spend. There were times when I was particularly stressed with email, and I'm not great at it now. But, you know, it is something you can learn to deal with. And in terms of sustainability, you know, the absolute collapse of receiving things on paper is a good thing. And as I say, you know, email, it's a bit like texting. You know, it's now quite an old technology, and it's not people able to demand to be in your time. What was really intrusive was when people could phone you up at any time, and now they can't because you turn the sound on your phone off. You don't have a landline. Many people don't have a landline, because everybody in the household has their own mobile phone, which means you're not picking the phone up for somebody else. You know, that's the kind of intrusiveness that has gone away. We're beginning to work out how to protect our lives better. And that's easy as long as the technology doesn't change. If somebody invents something new, so something that can talk directly into your brain, then we're in trouble. If somebody invents a form of transportation, a bit like Star Trek, where you can just instantaneously move from one place to another, then we're in trouble. Then we've got another innovation.
Yes, yes. So what are the socioeconomic implications of this idea of a slowdown in technology and innovation?
The really interesting one is how we end up living lives that are so much more similar to our children, if you're more age, than we live to our parents. We are used to generational change, and we still talk greatly about generational change. We talk about the Zoomers and Generation Z and Generation Y. Because we had these six or seven generations of incredible change. Before then, for the vast majority of people, even in the UK, life was very similar to their parents. You were in a village. You did what mum or dad did later. You lived in the kind of house that mum or dad had. You washed clothes in the same kind of way that they did. It was kind of groundhog generation again and again for most people, with the intermittent war and occasional great change. Then you get capitalism comes along, industrialization comes along, and every generation is living a life very unlike their parents, finding it hard to understand them, feeling disconnected and not knowing where things are going. Now that that rate of change has reduced, now that we're using the same technology that our children use, okay, they might use Snapchat and I don't, but it isn't that different. Now they're looking at the same kind of jobs that we do. We're not inventing that many new jobs. We still have constant AI scares. I'm skeptical about AI in the slowdown book, because I've been introduced to four AI revolutions in my lifetime. And in my PhD, I remember putting in, they just about managed to get an AI to be able to emulate a sea slug. Now it's seen as a big thing to do. Our current obsessions with AI are about pattern recognition. So the ability to recognize photographs, the ability to translate between languages automatically. This is a technology of pattern recognition. It's not, you know, when you talk, to that machine in your kitchen, and ask it to play you something from Spotify, it's pattern recognizing your voice. And it works because most of your requests are similar to other people's requests. You've only got to think of something really obscure to ask it to see it fail. So it isn't that revolutionary. I can bore you endlessly on this, but the most revolutionary thing in AI, and it really annoys AI enthusiasts, is John Conway's Game of Life of 1968. John Conway invented a little set of rules for how cells could turn on and off in an infinite board. And it actually allows you to create a logic gun, which would allow you to create a computer, which in effect could program itself. And this was 1968. Now that was revolutionary. That was exciting. And that was new, but it's a long, long, long time ago.
Yes, but I suppose in one aspect of that is that, you know, if you take the iPhone, it's well known that all of those bits were lying around in different areas in Xerox PARC, all that kind of thing. And they were all put together into something that is radically new. You know, being able to, you know, see people, to have your computer in your hand, all of that kind of thing. It was new, and yet it wasn't a breakthrough technology. It was lots of technologies that had been around. They reassembled in a particular way. That potential presumably still remains.
It presumably does, and you know the world will change in future. It's not going to suddenly stop. But the main thing that Apple did was to get you to love it. You know, it was the shape, it was the curve, and it was also the expense. It was the idea that you're getting something very special that was quite, and still is quite costly. But when you look, you know, so I have an Apple phone. I have Word on it and other things. I don't try and word process documents on my phone, even though I can. It doesn't work for me. It's too small. I do use it as a phone. I do use it to check emails. I use it because of a sort of sense of insecurity that I must always be connected. But I am only using a tiny fraction of what it can do. And one of the funniest things is it turned out that the quality of audio on an Apple phone is really good. So that if you're doing an interview with somebody, it was actually better than a studio line for the BBC. And they'd ask you, just press memo record on your Apple phone and send the audio. you know, but, yeah. But, you know, if in my head, that's the kind of most recent innovation in the last 2 years.
Yes.
Is simply high quality audio recording. It's not a huge step forward. Even getting a little, you know, if we could get a little hologram of you now, a bit like Star Wars, and you'd be appearing, okay, it'd be interesting, but we can do this discussion just as well without actually seeing each other.
Yes, I suppose I wanted to move on, but I can't help thinking that, you know, robots for car manufacturing, but, you know, those technologies which, so we're talking about consumer technologies on the one hand, but the technologies that go into industrial production and that kind of thing, that presumably could potentially, you know, I mean, they talk about the algorithms that, you know, are going to get rid of lawyers or I don't know what, in terms of, but, you know, significant potential there. But I suppose we've already...
No, let's talk, is it worth talking briefly about it? Yes. We've had 200 years of this. Right across Yorkshire, where my family came from, people used to weave in cottages, and then the looms came along. I grew up in Oxford. The most common job in Oxford was going to work in a car factory, 40,000 people. It was a terrible job. My dad took me into the car factory to make me work harder at school. Now you can go to the Oxford car factory, and it's beautiful. They're making the electric Mini. It's 1,200 silent robots, and it's stunning to watch. But it isn't that different from those looms. It's the same kind of thing. And the brilliant thing is, human beings were not made to be on production lines. So that technology I love, but it is that automation. It's largely been done. Go to any factory that makes almost anything in the world, and you don't see it.
Yeah, I suppose the worry is the white collar work, the management, and so forth. That's a whole other question, and obviously it's fascinating. Okay. And I'm finding myself in the place of saying, well, what about this and what about this?
Yeah.
I could go on forever. I was hoping not to get involved in that, but no, it's very, very interesting. It's rich because it makes you think about things again. What about the connection between technological change and cultural change? I'm not saying there's a direct relationship, but presumably in this, we're talking about a technological change not being so important. Change, yeah. social capital, have you any thoughts on that?
Well, I end the slowdown book talking about Japan, a place that in some ways has slowed down a lot, where the current rate of social change is very high. So a trite example I end with is how the royal family in Japan have now married into commoners and so on and don't use the same schools as before. It's a social change where I think we can see accelerations. Sexuality is a good example. The fact that people don't have to hide who they are, the fact that people are being accepted. Social change about racism. If you like, capitalism partly built up a particular kind of racism based on slavery and superiority, and it was ways in which you could justify growing inequalities. Watching the social change on racism at the moment, that's certainly an acceleration. So I end the slowdown book by saying many of the things I can measure are slowing down. And my feeling is that the things that are speeding up are things that I can't measure. But the speeding up change is social and cultural. It is how we respect and treat each other. It is differences between men and women and what people say. It is the idea of how we view children differently, the extent to which we listen to children, which we never used to do. They really were to be seen and not heard and, you know, used as labor. And hopefully, I mean, one we still haven't got to, but we don't tend to think about our last year of life. We don't think about the very, very elderly. And the minute we start thinking about that, we would change our society quite a lot. But we don't.
Yes. I was wondering at times, With the sense of some of these trends, that it is there a danger of a little bit of complacency for someone reading it to think, actually, things are going to work themselves out. You know, we're now heading towards zero growth. You know, that'll happen. We don't need to fight for political change. We don't need to, you know, population is falling, so it's not such an issue. That things kind of are working their way out. Where does the need to, you know, particularly with capitalism, which is such a powerful hybrid and mutating form, you know, that there will be new versions, and as the well-known quote, easier to imagine an end of the world rather than the end of capitalism. I just want your thoughts a little bit finally on that topic of political change.
No, it's a great one to end on, because there is a danger of complacency by looking at these trends and saying that they are on average going that way. I did it mainly because so many of the younger people than me that I teach have so little hope for the future. They really think that you shouldn't have children at all because there's no hope. The planet is going to burn. We will have wars. Fascism will rise and so on. So partly I concentrate on the positive things, because I think we need some hope, because without some hope, there is a great danger that people then don't fight for the positive changes that are needed to get this better world that is entirely possible. The problem with capitalism is it concentrates money into the hands of a few, and then they pay think tanks and other people to try to dominate. The interesting thing I've noticed recently is just how inane the arguments from the paid puppets have been. And I'm hoping that the younger generation also sees that as well. But you do have to fight. I once wrote a lovely edited book. I've forgotten the title, with Mary Shaw and George David Smith, where we looked at the greatest advances in medicine that had been made over 200 years, and social medicine society in general. And we went back and tried to find the original leaflet or pamphlet suggesting this be done. So an example was in the 1930s, somebody produced a pamphlet suggesting that doctors in England might want to work together and set up a practice where they all support each other and where you go if you're ill rather than having the individual doctor.
Radical.
it was radical at the time. And the nice thing about this was that every single, and you could also look at beginning of abolition of slavery and bigger things as well. But every single thing that's got better has only got better because somebody, normally a generation, if not two earlier, suggested it and argued for it. And the sad thing, or the thing to kind of forget about, is for every one of those effective documents, or nowadays it would be a YouTube video, there were tens of thousands of ones that never worked or got anywhere. But nothing good ever happens without somebody pushing for it. So you are completely right. But they need to know that they can get it. They need the optimism.
I think this is a hugely important question as well. And in terms of how the future has been dominated by particular pessimistic ideas, or the ability to imagine the future. I mean, it's a long trend in the environmental movement in terms of the way the stories have been told and the presentation and so forth. But, I think what you're saying is very interesting in terms of crowding out the imagination and possibilities. And I think I've forgotten the exact term that Mike Hume uses, but it's not climate essentialism, but it's the whole world just seen into the future through one variable, and one idea. I know there's danger of in the background this techno-utopianism thing, which is there as well. But I think this idea of the future is really important. It brings me to finally, what's next for you, Danny?
Oh, what's next? The next thing for me is a little book about Finland, which is actually called Fintopia, which should come out in the autumn. And it's an optimistic book because people like me tend to write books about things that go wrong, about inequality and angry books. Fintopia is about how Finland came over 100 years to end up being the country which is now, officially for the last 3 years, the happiest country in the world. But also has an aim to get to carbon zero by 2035, is run by five women, including the Green Party in there. And Finland scores first, second or third on over 100 social rankings of success around the world. It's the most successful place in the world, the best education system, the lowest rate of homelessness in Europe. You can go on and on and on. And the reason I wrote about Fintopia with Anika Kalogian, my Finnish co-author, was that successful places, environmentally successful, socially successful places, tend to be modest and don't shout about their success. Whereas places of failure, like the UK at the moment with Boris Johnson, talking about the best track and trace system in the world, or even worse, of course, the USA, making it great again with Trump, the failures shout out about how great they are and lie. The successful examples of human endeavour, because of modesty, tend not to say, look what we're doing here, look, it's working. And that's why Fintopia is the next project.
Well, I had hoped to talk to you about that, but there was so much to cover, and that was such a rich discussion. I wish you the very best with this new book, and look forward to reading it. And thank you so much for sharing all your ideas and inspiration today on the sustainability agenda, Danny.
Thanks ever so much for chatting. It's been lovely.
If you like what you heard today on the sustainability agenda, we think you'll enjoy Jason Hickel's powerful new book, Less is More, How Degrowth Will Save the World, which shows how we need to transform the dogmas of capitalism to forge a new system that is fit for the 21st century. Available online and at all good bookstores. Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.